Welcome to NSL Unscripted, your inside look at the evolving landscape of national security law, brought to you by the National Security Law Department at the U.S. Army's Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School. In each episode, we explore timely issues and trending topics with leading experts, practitioners, and academics in the field. Join us for a deeper dive into the critical topics that define national security law today.
Welcome to another episode of NSL Unscripted. I'm your host today, Major Fabiani Duarte, an associate professor at the National Security Law Department here at the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School for the Army here in Charlottesville, Virginia. Today, I'm very, very excited to be welcoming our dear friend and a fellow professor here in the department, Mr. Brandon Pugh, the principal cyber advisor to the Secretary of the Army. As the PCA, Mr. Pugh was presidentially appointed and is responsible for advising the Secretary of the Army and the Army Chief of Staff on all cyber matters, including issues of readiness, budget, capabilities, and strategy. Established by Congress in 2020, the PCA role is a three-star general equivalent that reports directly to the Secretary of the Army, briefs Congress, and operates as an independent office. There are only three PCAs for the Army, Navy, and Air Force. I got to know Mr. Pugh, as I mentioned, because he is in our faculty here in the NSL department, and he, as somebody who not only serves here as an academic, but previously was a paratrooper and an international law officer. Mr. Pugh is also a non-resident fellow in the Army Cyber Institute at West Point, among many other roles and boards that he sits on. He holds a JD from Rutgers Law, and his bachelor's is from the College of New Jersey. He also has a family of service because his lovely wife serves as an Air Force KC-46 pilot, and he's the proud dad of two kiddos. So, Mr. Brandon Pugh, welcome to our inaugural vodcast here at TJAGLIX.
Well, Fabi, thanks for having me, and your intro was way too kind. It's always nice to sit next to an Air Force member with my wife, but you know, it's really special to be on today. I mean, I've been fortunate to be on faculty here as a reservist for about 3 years, and it's awesome to see the schoolhouse lean into some of these new abilities to get information out to not only judge advocates, but really across the entire force, because these issues, you know, are really applicable to attorneys and non-attorneys. So being a small part of this today is really a neat and special opportunity for me.
Well, we're very excited to have you and honored because of your exciting new role. You know, you have so much, I think, to share with us. Would you mind this new role that was just established in 2020 by Congress? What kind of responsibilities do you have, and how has this role evolved?
So it really is a unique role. So it was made by the 2019 NDA, first staffed in 2020. And for attorneys listening, it's actually worth a read. It's a very prescriptive statute, which I think is selfishly a good thing because I know what I have to do. Congress delineates seven responsibilities that I'm held accounted for, or I'm accountable to, as well as a bonus eighth one, which is one we're leaning into. And I can kind of delve into them. It also goes as far as saying who I have to meet with on a routine basis. In statute, by title, it says, you shall meet with these people to force the role to be collaborative. Because, you know, initially it was made because there was a lot of people doing cyber in the military. You know, for our Army listeners, there's a G3, a head of our operations. We have a G6 who leads our signal corps. We have a CIO who does more of the policy aspects. And we also have a three-star in charge of our cyber. Congress thought there was a gap in terms of who was being aware and coordinating all those different entities, not leading those offices, but directly advising the secretary, so Secretary Driscoll, and the chief of staff, General George. So that's how our role comes in. I'm the third one, you know, in the Army, so really excited to be in the role about 7 months in. But it's, you know, the roles and responsibilities are pretty vast, so I can't do it alone.
Well, one of the things that we know is under your purview is something that we've really leaned into here at the JAG School, and that's AI. I along with my fellow Navy professor, Commander Delisa Zimmerman, kicked off our AI elective. And we've been able to really focus on how AI is evolving in our national security law practice, but in many areas of legal practice in the military. So where does your office fall in the role of AI, this new hot thing that is everywhere these days?
Yeah, and I promise I'll directly answer your question, but like taking a step back, I would say, You know, it's an exciting time to be doing cyber. And, you know, I should first add that, you know, our office kind of has three priorities. We have cyber, and then most recently electronic warfare, as well as information operations that we have oversight functions for. That's in addition to what Congress gave us. But one of the priorities for Secretary Driscoll, as well as General George, has been Army continuous transformation, which I'm sure, you know, many have heard of. At a high level, that is, how are we preparing the Army for that future battlefield, that future fight? One of, from my vantage point, that is largely dependent on technology and cyber, and that's why it's so exciting for me, because, you know, Secretary of War gave Sec Army a few priorities. Two of the top five were cyber and EW, which was really exciting to see our office be able to lean into them. But to kind of pull one of those threads, we have four priorities in the office. The one I listed first was AI specifically, or artificial intelligence. And a lot of people do AI within the Army, and I think that's important to recognize because there are different levels of expertise. Our office falls in as, how is AI being leveraged for cyber defense, cyber offense, as well as protecting us against potential threats? And I think that's really where AI is an extraordinary opportunity to really close that gap between a potential adversary and a good actor on cyber. AI can automate a lot of that and help us better detect threats. And we've done a really good job, I would say, in the Army already. But I'd say there's many more areas that we can lean into when it comes to AI for cyber.
So cyber attacks are something that we hear about a lot. You know, just a few weeks ago, all the cell phone towers went down for a moment. And of course, being in the NSL department, I was like, oh my goodness, this is a cyber attack. It looks like it was just an issue with one of the providers. But this is appearing to become a norm, something that we hear about a lot. And it's not just a Netflix storyline. So how is your office thinking about defense of critical infrastructure, DCI, in the face of this heightening threat?
Yeah, so, you know, kind of going back to our statutory responsibilities, our role has a role in defense, defending Army weapon systems, defending our networks, defending our supply chain. That's all within our office's oversight functions. One area that we have pulled out among our priorities, and you're doing a good job teeing up our priorities, is around defense critical infrastructure. So what does that mean? You know, the number sometimes varies. I always like to say we have 288 camps, posts, and stations in the Army. And that can vary. But most of them rely on private critical infrastructure. So think water, electric, gas. And in a time of conflict, an adversary could potentially go after one of those private operators to disrupt our ability to project forces. So moving troops, equipment, in a time of conflict. And that's really a no-fail mission. So that's one of the reasons our office has been really just one of the benefits of having a senior role in the Pentagon is we can drive priorities and help raise the attention to things. Not necessarily run everything, but to involve all the relevant stakeholders. DCI, or Defense Critical Infrastructure, is one of those areas. This should be a concern everybody has in the Army, and making sure we prioritize investments, making sure we're putting the right security procedures in place to make sure our installations are protected, especially in the face of a potential adversary.
What are some examples of DCI that we could that you could provide us that we need to be prioritizing protecting?
Yeah, so I think a few things there. If somebody's not up to speed, a really good resource they could read to learn more would be the Army Cyber Institute has had a research project for maybe 10 years, let's say, called the Jack Voltaic Series. And essentially what they do every single year is look for two major U.S. cities. And from the DOW vantage point, we're looking for those cities that are near major installations, and essentially showing how can cyber attacks against those cities perhaps disrupt U.S. military bases. And I think what we have found was sometimes the disruptions to electric and gas coming to the bases, that can have severe consequences. So I guess what's the next step? So there could be a temptation to say, let's just go after all 288 bases. It comes down to a bandwidth issue and a resourcing. So the question I've had is there a way to prioritize those installations, saying we're going to fund resources and collectively focus on a handful of sites that have the most concern to us? And I think it's important to recognize this isn't just an Army issue. This isn't really just a Department of War issue. This is an interagency challenge, I would say. And there's many federal partners that have equities here, like CISA, or the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, the Department of Energy for our electric grid. And many more. This is a holistic challenge, I would say, we face, and the Army sees this as one key component of that.
As we face these challenges, we need people to face them, And so developing that cyber workforce is key, right? How can we, you know, I'm in the Air Force, but, you know, working here at an Army JAG school in the Department of War, what can we do to kind of attract that a talented cyber workforce in a world that's very competitive, where, you know, private industry offers a lot of carrots that are attracting some of these talented players. What can we do to be more competitive and bring these competitive people into the team?
Yeah, you said something that's really key, is that at the end of the day, people are essential. And I think it's so easy to focus on technology and cyber capabilities. And don't get me wrong, that's important. But the foundation is still the people. The Army is still a people business. We need to care about those in uniform as well as our civilians. And cyber is no exception. Matter of fact, I think it's actually an area that's an imperative in making sure we're getting the right people with the right expertise and talent, or at least the aptitude to get there, to help not only defend ourselves, but to potentially be on keyboard to do potential effects against an adversary. And I think it's two sides of that. We also need those that are just, you know, forward-leaning in innovation. We need people that are very familiar with artificial intelligence, that can think through novel applications and also protect artificial intelligence. But so how are we getting after that? I guess I see the issue twofold, the civilian front as well as the military front. On the civilian front, there's been a program for a few years now called the Cyber Expected Service, or CES. It's a congressional authority we've had, and think of it as a way to bring somebody into federal service much quicker than the typical hiring process, and potentially at higher pay rates. So you could still be the same GS number, let's say, but start with a TLMS, or a target local market supplement, potentially, you know, at a significantly higher base rate. That's a way to attract quality civilians. On the military side, I think there's a lot to unpack there. How are we making sure we're training our existing cyber forces and making sure they're progressing and becoming more lethal and better skilled at their jobs, like any career field? But I'd say cyber is imperative because of how quickly the space is moving and how quickly that threat landscape evolves. You know, we probably don't have the time to delve too far into it, but just to tee up for any listeners, is CyberCom 2.0. So this is something Secretary of War signed out a few months ago at this point. And that is really getting at that man, train, equip, and force generation challenge. How the military departments, so think, you know, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps, Army, presenting forces to U.S. CyberCom and making sure they're the right trained forces, that they are being recruited initially. That has been a challenge we face, is the man, train, equip function. And for a four-star combatant commander, in my own perspective, that's really not something that is sustainable. So CyberCom 2.0 is a way to get after that and make sure our ecosystem in cyber is significantly stronger, and that the military departments are working hand in hand with the Department of War as well as U.S. CyberCom.
Okay, wow, CyberCom 2.0, very, very interesting. And you talked about CES. Are these the programs that you're referencing that were used to attract some of the leaders or industries, executives from some of these tech firms or AI industry to join? I remember a big headline when these new lieutenant colonels were minted and brought in from industry to provide their expertise directly to the Department of War.
Yeah, and so a little different. I think a key point that I like to remind myself is there's no one single pathway to serve in the military. You know, you might enter as a traditional civilian. You might enter in uniform. What you're getting after is another avenue, is our direct commissioning process. And we've had direct commissioning similar to JAG Corps for a long time. We also have that for cyber. So if you have a, you know, a unique skill set, perhaps you don't need to go through the same training pipeline as maybe in somebody in combat arms. And sometimes you're not going to be leading a formation, but you have a unique skill set that the Army or the Air Force in your case needs to champion on. So one of those efforts was called Detachment 201. Hmm. And that was exactly what you were getting at, bringing in very highly qualified individuals from industry as lieutenant colonels, and giving them an opportunity to help solve the hardest problems the Army is facing. You know, they're seeing these complex challenges of civilians and thinking of innovative approaches. If there's a way for the Army to leverage that just in uniform, in the eyes of our leadership, that has been great. And I agree. I think things like that are specifically needed when it comes to tech and cyber, just to recruit people that might not see themselves in uniform in a traditional sense.
You talked about all these different paths that we can build our cyber warfighters, right? You're a reservist, all right? And you obviously see the importance of the reserve component to work a lot with the guard component. But what are some ways that we can add them to the cyber force mix? And how do you see that maybe evolving as you talk about all these different pathways, the direct commissioning, the detachment to 201,
yes,
right, et cetera?
Yeah, so I see cyber as really an all compo fight and all compo issue. We need active duty, reservists, guardsmen, and perhaps even, you know, civilian auxiliary in some cases. And that's a whole separate thread. Some states have, you know, brought people in, not in uniform per se, but are supporting the department. I think a key part of that is specifically our compo 2 and 3. These are individuals sometimes that are working in really complex cyber environments as civilians and know their local communities well. So think of DCI going full circle. Who would be better to help address local critical infrastructure concerns than somebody that might work for their local electric company doing it in a cyber role? Using that talent in our guard and reserve, I think, is key. I think that puts the burden on us, not just as a service, but even as a broader department, to make sure we're fully utilizing those individuals and helping individuals see that as a potential pathway. But then once they do enter, how are we making sure they're actually doing a cyber mission set? You know, I can think of, so, you know, a bad scenario would be all they do is just their basic soldier readiness skills. And that's important. Like, you know, at the end of the day, we're all airmen and soldiers. We need to shoot. We need to qualify for health, you know, and so on. But you should also be having ample time to do your actual mission, what you are trained for. And I think that's just something we should always be assessing is, are we fully utilizing all compos to get after cyber, especially realizing their unique skill sets that they bring to the table?
Wow. That's really exciting, you know, for a lot of folks who are serving in active duty and want to continue to be involved if they're retiring or separating or looking at these other avenues is really, really fascinating.
And you're spot on. And I think, you know, sometimes we do, just like the JAG Corps, I entered actually just as a reservist. Same thing. We might have some people that leave active duty that need to continue to serve. They might see a job in the industry. I'd rather see them, you know, if they do decide to leave active duty service, how do we keep them involved? I think the Guard and Reserves are a great opportunity to do that.
We just wrapped up a big course here at the JAG School that one of my colleagues course managed, it's called the Emerging Topics in Technical and Technology and Acquisitions course, right? You know, the vision behind that is really to bring the leaders in the DOW in the acquisition space and to bring a spotlight on the evolving cyber and tech world, right? For AI and all these new capabilities. But the thing is, those capabilities are evolving at lightning speed, right?
Yep.
So how do you reconcile this technology that is exploding, right, on the one side and going a million miles a minute, and an acquisitions and budgeting process that isn't always famously as spry.
Yes.
Right. And I know there's been new initiatives from the Secretary of War and from the administration to try to make that a little bit quicker, a bit more efficient. How do you reconcile both of those things, especially as we face this new cyber world, right? This new cyber threat in front of us.
Yeah, great question. And I'm glad you teed up the Emerging Topics course, because that's really an incredible course. I'm sure all the short courses here at the Schoolhouse are good, but that I've now attended that course 3 years in a row and have spoke each year. Just the caliber of speaker that comes out and the timeliness of the topics. Acquisition is a great topic. You know, some people might say, well, how does national security law combine with acquisition? And the reality is they are very linked. You know, when we need novel capabilities in the tech and cyberspace, we have to have a way to acquire them. And I'd say the timeliness factor is key there. You know, we don't have the luxury of time. We can't take 2 or 3 years in some cases to bring on a novel piece of technology, whether it be AI or cyber. So something that our leadership, really starting at the top with Secretary Driscoll, has challenged is how we bring things in quicker. Army has undergone acquisition reform after the department did their acquisition reform rollout. We're very much in the weeds with that now. And I think there's a lot of threads to pull there. One is, how are we opening ourselves to all different types of companies? So not just our largest companies. If you're a small company, you might be a 3 or 4 person VC-backed firm, and you have a novel product, how are we bringing that capability in? It shouldn't be seen as this is an insurmountable obstacle, we can never sell to the Army. That's not the case. Second is, We're really looking to industry to help identify unique innovations. We don't want to necessarily be the one saying, well, we have a problem, now let's go look for potential solutions. There's really a burden on industry, I would say. If you know a potential innovation we need or product, we might not even know that, but we want to learn from you. And I'd say third is the time aspect. So a program I'm really passionate about is called FUZE, or F-U-Z-E. It's really, that is one aspect of our innovation pipeline. And that has brought together a number of discrete innovation pathways into one umbrella. And the overall premise is speed. So for prototypes, getting a pathway to funding in 10 days and potentially getting a prototype to an actual Army unit in 30 to 45 days, which if you know the Pentagon, 30 to 45 days to get a product in the hands of an actual soldier is lightning speed. And I think that is key when it comes to to technology. Fourth thing, I know I almost promised three, is getting the hands of these products in the hands of soldiers from the very outset. So rather waiting until the end of the acquisition process to say, well, let's see if this actually is what we need or what a soldier needs, let's do it early on. Let's have it tested by a soldier. It'll either be successful or it'll fail, but at least we'll be able to see, do we need to manipulate it or do we just abandon that process?
This is obviously a priority right now for the Department of War. With the PCA role, right, obviously the creation of this role, there's a real champion for these types of things. How do you ensure unity of effort with different offices that also have these stated missions? You know, I think of the Army CIO G6 or the Army Cyber Command. How do you coordinate those efforts to really make maximum impact, as opposed to doing piecemeal or counterproductive advancement?
You're spot on. The last thing you'd want is siloed efforts and everybody working in different directions. I think the advantage we have now, the CIO, the G6, the R-Cyber CG, and myself, is we all like to collaborate and there's routine conversation. So we generally know what we're all working on. You know, obviously there's nuance to some of our portfolio. Some things I would do just interest me, but to the degree there's overlap, I think all four of us, not to overspeak for them, are interested in working together. And we have one-on-one touch points. We also have group touch points just to make sure even at the three-star level or three-star equivalent level, we're having those conversations and really expecting the same thing for our staffs. I know everybody on my team is having routine touch points with those teams as well to make sure we're all tracking what we're doing and ultimately moving in the same direction. At the end of the day, we're all here to support the president. We're all here to support our civilian leadership, Tesco Driscoll, as well as General George, and also to help the Army. Like, how are we making sure the Army is moving forward? So I'd say if we're all laser focused in that same mission, it makes sense for us to work together. And I see all three of those individuals to be great teammates and somebody that I'm proud to work with.
And that's assistance you're getting internally. How about externally? What can industry partners do to make your job easier and to help us, in the Department of War, to help us in the National Security Law Department, to help our cyber warriors out there, our AI innovators, our EW technicians and strategists to do better and to succeed?
Yeah, I think industry is an essential player here. And kind of like what I was alluding to before, of all types of industry, whether you're small, medium, or large, if you have potential products that could have a home in the Army, I think it's coming up on that and letting us know of those products. I'd say it's also incumbent on us to also work with industry. I know personally, I try to engage with industry, whether I'm at conferences, meeting with them in my office. It's a way just for me to learn. And there's a lot of unique products out there that I wasn't even aware of existed. And I think that's the key. It should be a mutual relationship. I can learn from them. If there's a potential opportunity for them in the Army, that's great. And I think it's also recognized this is I see a lot of things in the eyes of the Army. This is really a team sport. I should be making sure I'm tracking what the Air Force is doing, what the Navy is doing, as well as our Assistant Secretary of War counterpart, the Honorable Katie Sutton. That's a OSW office that also focuses on cyber. All that to say, it is internal, external with DOW supporters, as well as industry. We all should be strengthening our cyber defenses, as well as looking at how we can employ cyber against a potential adversary. That should be our ultimate guiding star.
All right, well, Brandon, you've given us a lot to think about and to work with today. I really appreciate you being here for our NSL Unscripted Vodcast inaugural episode.
Yeah, yep.
And Good luck in your role as a PCA, and we hope to have you back for not just another vodcast, but in the classroom lecturing our students and sharing this cyber gospel that you're going around and promoting. So we appreciate it.
You're too kind, Fabi. I'm always happy to come back, and I'm going to hold you to visiting me at the Pentagon sometime. We love visitors, so we'll have to have you by to come to the office or have lunch or something. It'd be terrific.
Well, sure. If I could get one of those shiny pins like that, that'd be super cool.
Oh, yeah. Shameless plug for those that are listening. People are like, hey, how do I, if we have the time, how do I enter cyber? I didn't mention earlier, one of the things our office runs is the Secretary's Strategic Cyber Seminar, and that's the pin I'm wearing. Actually, that is roughly 10 to 12 individuals, enlisted leaders, warrant officers, as well as commissioned officers, that come together over the course of the year. It's Secretary of the Army endorsed, and it's run by myself and the commanding general of our cyber to really bring and train that future cyber workforce and leaders. And you don't have to be a cyber officer. So judge advocates, and we had multiple apply this year, can freely apply. It's a neat opportunity for them to learn about cyber and technology over the course of the year. So I would encourage judge advocates to consider applying for those that are in the Army.
And again, that program is called the...
It's the full name I'll probably butcher, but it's the Secretary of the Army Strategic Cyber Seminar. And we just started our first cohort in June, so don't hold me to this, but roughly people could expect the next window to open up over the summer to apply for the following year, which will start of January of 27. So you can start planning now. And I would just pay attention. There are rank requirements, but it's we want a broad net of people.
What a cool opportunity. Thank you for sharing that. And I'm glad I asked about the cool shiny pin.
So we'll get you a pin.
All right. Well, thank you very much for tuning in to this episode. And we'll see you next time on NSL Unscripted. Thanks so much.
This episode of NSL Unscripted was brought to you by the National Security Law Department at the U.S. Army's Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School. The views presented are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent the views of the Department of Defense, its components, the Department of the Army, or the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School. Our department also publishes the Operational Law Handbook available online. We hope you enjoyed this episode and look forward to future episodes for NSL practitioners.